thank you very much for your invitation, your kind invitation to, particularly to Santiago and Mika. It's, I'm happy to be included in this series of seminars on reproduction migration in Asia Pacific. It's not an area I've been working on for all my academic life. I started working on marriage migration as part of the project about immigration to China, which we've been collaborating with colleagues in Europe and China. And it started with our interest and observation that there is a growing shift migration trends in Asia, and China is now becoming a popular destination for career, for life pursuits, for marriage, and traditionally China has been perceived as a country which exports migrants to the rest of the world, to Asia and developed West, but increasingly more and more people are seeking to settle in China, and we were interested in kind of observing and understanding what's happening on the ground and theorizing what it means for our understanding and theorizations of migration in the region and more globally. So I come to present in this series from the position of this researcher who's been collaborating with colleagues on this project. And Mika mentioned that I looked at marriage migration trends in China-Vietnam context, but for the purpose of this presentation, I'm only talking about what we've been doing with this research project on the China-Russian side of things. And disciplinary, I am based in the politics department at the University of Manchester, but intellectually, academically, I state myself more closely in the area of human geography, political sociology, and also anthropology. So a lot of intellectual ideas are coming from the kind of crossing the disciplinary borders and cross-fertilizations of ideas across disciplines. In terms of the talk today, since this series of talks invites us to identify kind of analytical lenses and new ways of talking about reproduction migration in Asia Pacific, I would like to dwell on this idea of intimate geopolitics as a potential of intimate geopolitics to engage with marriage migration and as a kind of analytical lens to understand and tease out processes and relationships which come out of this analytical angle and empirical in empirical field. And so I'll talk briefly about intimate geopolitics as analytical lens for in my research. And the entry points to engage with intimate geopolitics in the People's Republic of China. So I will talk specifically about body, home, and border. Then talk about research context, how I came about working on this topic, questions which I am asking, and broaden out my research questions into national security discourses, how marriage migration has been perceived and talked about at the national level in China currently, but also historically. So track some historical trends and how they've been recently revived in media representations of cross-border Chinese Russian influences and what that mean for national security. And in the last part of the talk, I'll share some of my research kind of findings, what I've been researching and some of the observations I've come up with so far. So hopefully I'll be able to stick to 1 hour, but I might need to rush through some of the slides. So part one, intimate geopolitics. So what is, for the second half of the seminar, we have a seminar with students in the afternoon. And one of the questions I've asked students to think about, what is intimate geopolitics and why is it a useful analytical concept to examine marriage migration? I wonder if anyone of you has come across some literature and readings on intimate geopolitics. No? Okay, good. I draw on publications in the fields of political human geography and international relations, and particularly been paying attention to how recent studies been grappling with global and the intimate, and how they've been theorized, analyzed, not as separate spheres, but how they've been seen as co-constitutive, as intimately related in a number of complex ways. So that and increasing number of publications look at these spheres of processes, relationships, experiences, not as disconnected, but as connected at multiple levels across global, local, and history-present continuums. So we don't start kind of analysis of marriage migration from what's happening in the global and in the local, but look at how this global and local come together in manifesting a variety of places, phenomena, kind of discourses, and experiences. I think what's potentially productive with this intimate as analytical lens is that it enables this kind of kaleidoscopic view of geopolitics with its multi-scalar connections and at the global, local, history-present trends. Another important feature of intimate geopolitics is the importance of emotions and affect as seen as inseparable from political geographies. Here I draw on work by anthropologists such as Navarro Yashin, who talks about irrational foundations of rationalized state practices, but also political and human geographers, as Rachel Payne Staheli, who talk about intimate intimacy geopolitics and the central role of emotions such as fear in global politics, and Spike Peterson, who is a professor in Arizona University. So that's another aspect of intimate geopolitics which I find important. It's emotions and affect. And the third important, useful aspect of it, it's the embodied part of the social relations, the central role of material aspects of how intimate geopolitics play out in families, for individuals, but also at the state level. But most importantly, is blurring these distinctions between intimate and global, dichotomized and hierarchical relations, which I find stimulating and promising. And the way I do it with the help of Amundsen and Heinemann's article, 2006 article, is to think about this interplay connections between global and intimate through how they manifest in particular sites or analytical angles. It's body, home, and border. And with it, I'm kind of taking you to my empirical context of China. So how I unpack and how I'm thinking with intimate geopolitics as analytical lens in China. Through this concept of body, which in China takes a particular formulation of a population question, which has two aspects to it, quality and quantity. Another analytical angle is idea of home, and in recent years, how it's been presented in the national media, national debates. It's through the discourses on marriage crisis, missing wives, and leftover women, but for purposes of my focus on marriage migrations, missing wife problem, which is particularly significant. And the third aspect is the boredom. And the way I engage with this idea of border, it's crossing the borders of intercultural borders, borders of household, family, and the national borders, so citizenship practices, how women who find themselves entering in Chinese family, how they negotiate their new status of a foreign wife, being a foreigner in the country, and kind of daughter-in-law. So how, what it means for them to navigate this new regulatory, cultural, and emotional regimes of being a foreign spouse in China. So these are kind of the main analytical angles of my take on marriage migration, the analytical framework, so to say. research context, how I came about to working on this topic, and it's sort of happened by chance. In 2014, I was still working on the Chinese-Vietnamese border in Guangxi, in Nanning, and a friend of mine there said that he read about a Russian bride's village in northern eastern part of China. So I was in the southwest, and there are many Vietnamese brides villages in that part of China. And he was telling me that there are similar villages in the opposite part of China near the Russian border. So I became interested in finding some of these villages, and I googled, Russian bride's village in the Chinese internet, and a series of publications came up, all referring to the same place in Jilin province called Sichuan. And according to this series of Chinese publications about the village, in the 90s, 20 old men from the village went to Russia to work on the markets to sell hats and leather products, and they made money, they became successful businessmen, and not only that, they came back to China with Russian wives. So according to this series of publications, 22 beautiful, happy marriages were formed, and now that village became a legend, not only in Jilin province, but in the whole of China. So I wanted to go and interview some of these families, find out about their lives, about how they met, and what it meant for them now to live in rural China. And then when I eventually went there in 2016, it turned out that none of these families were living in the village. And the only piece of relevant information which I found out was that this village, Sichuan, was used as a setting for a TV drama series called Dongbei Aitingushi, a North Chinese love story, which exactly narrated this story that two boys from a village in Jilin went to Russia, became a successful businessman, he came back to China with two Russian brides, Katya and Dunya. And what it opened up, it opened space for this new kind of reproductions of this narrative trope that if you go to Russia and become successful businessman or student, you will be attractive to women there, and you will find a wife. So it's this what these narratives do, and it's not the only one. There's another one, Border Natasha, which was a very popular TV drama in China. What this media or cultural products do, they create the desirability of Chinese masculinity to foreign women, in particular post-Soviet women. And these TV productions, representations, they present a particular image of these Russian women as kind of sexy, powerful, but that they are attracted to Chinese men, and they are happy to be absorbed into the Chinese order, in Chinese family, into Chinese household, and they accept their status and role there. So, for example, in that film, one of the women, Curtis, she didn't want to have children. She thought have children is kind of old-fashioned. She wanted to start her own business in China, but then through a lot of family work, through conversations with her husband and the parents-in-law, she became pregnant and super fertile. She was pregnant with twins, so kind of she even exceeded the expectations of the family. So what I wanted then to do with this further step in my research is to trace some of the real families, find Russian Chinese families, and understand more about this gap, kind of this juncture between the representation, this oversaturated media representation of these marriages, and how it is for them in real life. So what it means to be married to a Chinese man. So some of the questions that I've been asking, so how are women represented in the media, but also for those who are really married and live in China, how is their status governed across legal, cultural, and familial spheres? How do women come to China, and how do they adapt to their life, new life conditions? And I've been collecting life stories. So far, I've collected 50 life narrative life stories. Did interviews with the Russian embassy and consulates in Beijing and Shenyang. And been analyzing legal documents, regulatory changes, media productions, and doing digital ethnography, following some of these women and their discussions in WeChat groups. Before I move on to talk about my empirical findings, I mentioned that it's also important to think about marriage with foreigners in the context of national security, how marriage with foreigners is perceived in discourses about China's nation and national security specifically. And marriage migration is a gendered phenomenon everywhere, and particularly how it's governed, not only in China, but particularly in China. It's securitized and it's highly gendered. And historically, marriages with foreigners were being perceived as matters of national security. For example, this poster campaign, which dates back to 2016, is being released as part of the first celebration of National Security Education Day on the 15th of April 2016. And this poster appeared in Beijing, in the residential parts of Beijing. And what they do, they warn innocent Chinese girls about the perils of relationship with Western guys. It says that be suspicious of the real intentions of the Western man disguised as language teachers, English language teachers, because many of them are spies. And what it says that this English language teacher, this seduced a Chinese female Chinese civil servant, and she revealed some classified information to him, and public security I found the couple, and it landed them sentenced in prison. So that's one aspect of how this relationship with foreigners is perceived. But it has to do with this kind of national anxiety over the loss of Chinese women as a result of decades-long family planning, but also immigration of Chinese women to the West for marriage and education pursuits and career developments, and this increasing trope of kind of leftover women, which now constitutes part of the national security question in China. But also marriages with Chinese women to foreigners is a taboo, it's a sensitive topic. And it's not improved as a topic for cultural products by Chinese census. For example, Rachel Davosky, this woman here, wrote a memoir about her experiences of being involved in the very popular Chinese TV series, Beijing, Foreign Babes in Beijing. Mm-hmm. In 1990s, it was very popular in China. I don't know if anyone has seen this series now. And a few years ago, she wrote a memoir about being filmed in this TV series. And what she says there, that to Chinese producers, it wouldn't be possible to portray a relationship of a Chinese woman with a Western man. However, it was much safer and permissible for them to depict China kind of conquering the West through bodies of white women. And that's kind of two sides of the way marriages with foreigners are perceived in the Chinese national security discourses. How about Russia? Russia occupies a sort of a special place in Chinese national imagination because it's a territorial neighbor, so it's and it's a country which shares the longest border, land border with China, yet culturally very distant, unknown, and misunderstood in many ways. And I think it's also important not only to see how these marriages are presented in contemporary cultural and political discourses, but also trace how it's their history, how they've been looked at historically. And the migration across Chinese-Russian border, and particularly marriage migration, this intimate relations across the border, part of the geopolitical expansion of Russia into Manchuria and Far East. Chinese migration to China, Chinese migration to Russia was part of the kind of, it should be understood in relation to the construction of two biggest geopolitical projects, Trans-Siberian railway across the whole of Russia and the construction of the port of Vladivostok. So by the time of Russian Revolution in 1917, it's estimated that 150,000 Chinese were living and working on Russian projects in along the border. And it led to a lot of new relationships, a lot of families that visitors to Russian Far East estimate that in the 30s there was a emergence of new kind of race of Euro-Asian observed in the area, that there were fears but also predictions that there were more and more Euro-Asian people settling and emerging in that part of Russia. And traces of this kind of new kind of people are observed, noticeable in the what's happening in China nowadays. Kind of the reinventions and reenactments of this past are happening, particularly in the part of China close to Russian border. For example, in March 2013, a Suifenghe, a small town on the border with Russia, built a memorial museum dedicated to the life of Galina Dubeeva, who was a daughter born to Ukrainian Chinese family. And she was largely unknown to general public in China. Nobody knew about Galina Dubeeva until in the early 2000s, a journalist, Chinese journalist, came across her story She was fluent Japanese speaker, and during the anti-Japanese occupation war, she was sent by Chinese army representatives to negotiate with the Japanese side, and she never came back from commission, and her body disappeared. So when the journalist came across her story in the local archives, it became a sensation in the local media first, then the national authorities picked up this story, and she became kind of the face of Sui Fung He. And there was a whole campaign, a realization campaign of the life story. What's interesting in the museum in particular, it's how the qualities of this mixed race girl are celebrated. She's portrayed as a romantic, as a strong-willed, as very adventurous, brave, who is, and very patriotic, would be ready to dedicate and sacrifice her life for her mother, motherland. And it's interplayed together, kind of juxtaposed against the speeches and quotes from Xi Jinping and Putin. So Galina Bay became an angel of peace, who he symbolizes close relations between China and Russia, and remembers the common enemy of the past. And again, I think it's important to take into account how this marriage, but particularly descendants of those marriages, are celebrated, how they're talked about in cultural products such as the museum. Okay. So that's kind of the political, cultural, and historical context to how I'm framing my analysis. Now back to these three entry points, kind of analytical entry, analytical points to intimate geopolitics, how I'm unpacking them in the Chinese context. Body, family, home, and border. And as I said, the way I'm thinking about the body is through the concept of population question in China. Ranko Wenti. And this population question and governance of population have been vital to the rise of global China. At the beginning of the reform period, the demographic problem in China, so it's late 70s, was termed and framed in terms of the crisis of modernization. There were too many people in China, and there were too many people of a kind of backward kind. They had backward bodies, backward minds, and they were uncompetitive and prepared for China's role in the global rise, global economy. So the party articulation of this population question has been one of the central questions for the whole of reform period. And this problem, population question, has been generally well studied in sociology of China, in anthropology of China. There is many publications on how population question has been framed, formulated, and implemented. However, there has been in recent years have been new changes, and one of them is now that we recognize that we've managed successfully to control population growth. Now we need to do revert, and we need to do more about population quality. And population quality is the other side. So here we say population growth, and there it's population quality. The population quality, which is the other side of population question, is being seen as a catch-all phrase for developing superior, healthier, well-mannered people, which would be ready for China's global role in the global economy. It initially it was eugenic, that and aimed at prevention of defective birth in China. But increasingly, it expanded to such areas as education, its manners, and more and more health. There are the four dimensions of population quality and quantity: it's late birth, late marriage, it's eugenics, and restricted birth. And it's interesting that these four principles haven't really changed. The only principle which changed in recent years, in 2016, is the limited birth. So now people in China can have more than one child, they can have two. But it's been seen as also kind of part of population quantity, which we need now to rectify because of significant side effects that has been causing Chinese nation. And this graph basically shows how China's population growth compares to the world's population growth since 1916. So while the population growth has increased by 59.6%, China's population growth has only increased by 38.7%. And it's only if you look at the quantity side of things. If you look at the quality, which I'm going to look at in the next slide, you'll see that there are more problems. But the important message from that is that now the party is emphasizing, well, there are signs that will be promoting more births. For example, in August 2018, the National Post released these stamps for the upcoming year of pig. And the way this stamp was interpreted was that now we will see a new policy which will be promoting two and three children. So there's this family of pigs with three piglets. another important aspect of population question, which's been causing a lot of debates and concerns in China, is this gender imbalance and the missing wife problem, particularly for a generation of men born during the one-child policy. So it's from 1978 and onwards. So in January 2015, and it was probably one of the first times when the state acknowledged this problem publicly. The National Bureau of Statistics published a press release in both in Chinese and English about China's economic performance in the previous year, 2014. And one of these aspects of the report, sections of the report, mentioned that there was a growing problem in the population structure of China, highlighting that in 2014 there were 33 million less women than men. So that by 2030, 30 million men of marriageable age will be struggling to find wives in China. And it led to many discussions about potential problems for social stability, because what would do these 30 million bachelors do, where what they're going to do to try to find a wife, social stability, economic performance, and so forth. But they also, that's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is the dropping, steady decrease of marriage registrations in China, that people are less and less willing to get married. So the party has been looking for various policy responses, how to mitigate this problem. So I'm kind of thinking about it in a graphic way. And all these demographic projections and the concerns associated with them are producing a lot of debate. So one of them, for example, is that the two-child policy will be further relaxed, will be maybe unrestricted. In summer 2018, there were a lot of discussions in Chinese media about the possible introduction of so-called reproduction fund, which will be penalizing families with no children, so double income, no kids families, and they will be subsidizing families with more births. And also in June 2017, there were reports in Chinese media about the party, growing party role in helping people who are struggling to find partners to meet. So there was a new marriage and dating division of the Communist Youth League in Zhejiang province, and they are now setting up a kind of dating site for the young communists to meet. And that's kind of the official way of looking at things. But Chinese netizens are also engaging with this problem of missing wives and looking for possible ways of mitigating. So when this report of National Statistical Bureau was released, it attracted a lot of activity among Chinese netizens. And one of these reactions was these curious publications about what to do for those who are struggling to find a wife in China. And basically, the author of this publication suggests that this struggling man should go abroad. And they're creating a kind of a hierarchy of foreign brides. And on the first place are Russian women, on the second, Ukrainian women. And what's interesting about this publication is that it's written in a very militarist language. So the gender problem in China is presented as in terms of war. There is a gender war, and we need to counterattack through this conquering of foreign women. And on the first place, you go to Russia and then Ukraine. But also what's interesting, if you look at the moment, historical moment when it happened, 2015, it was when the war was unfolding in Crimea, in eastern Ukraine. So Ukraine all of a sudden gained a lot of presence in Chinese media. And people finally found out what where Ukraine is, and the potential that it created, this war war in the region created for Chinese men. So they say that there are lots of women who are desperate, and there is a potential for Chinese men to do something about it. It's also the language of One Belt, One Road has been also kind of co-opted in the publications, and new initiatives to create opportunities for dating agencies. So this guy, and I don't have time to go into this story, but he's a very popular figure in China, Meier and Tsai, who married a Ukrainian wife and then published his pictures of the family in Chinese internet, became a celebrity overnight, attracting thousands of messages from desperate Chinese men to help them to find a wife of his. So he created an agency in Kharkov and use the language of One Belt, One Road to say that through my agency I help people in China to meet and find Ukrainian wives. And in Beijing last year, adverts like that appeared saying that if you want to find a bride alone, One Belt, One Road, call this number. And it also kind of using a very official language that it's Ministry of Civil Affairs, which is funding this program. But what's interesting, I want last summer, Douyin, which is a very popular application in China, where people upload their videos, this video appeared, and I'm sorry, it's in Chinese, but I played just to give you a flavor of how of the language in which these marriages between, in this particular case, Ukrainian women and Chinese men are presented. Oh, sorry. Basically, a Ukrainian girl in very fluent Chinese saying that there are many more women than men in Ukraine and we can't find boyfriends. So please, Chinese man, please, Chinese friends, come and help us to become happy and fulfilled. We are waiting for you. So there was a lot of discussion, kind of, why would someone do it, how much they had to pay her to do something like that. But what comes out of these various kind of discursive tropes in China, happening official, semi-official, but commercial, and this personal spheres, is that Russian Ukrainian women are becoming very much accessible, presented as accessible, available, and preferred idealized images of foreign wives. They're racialized, they're sexualized, they're domesticated, are thus necessary for the national reproduction of the Chinese nation, both quantitatively, because there are missing wives, but also qualitatively because of their features. And they kind of fill in this gap, and also through kind of the desire of more mixing, blood mixing between Asian and white people. And while the number of marriages are insignificant, statistically insignificant, there is a lot of publicity. The idea of such marriages appeals to the Chinese public, to Chinese media, and there is a lot of efforts and energies invested in covering and presenting this topic. So headlines present that women are seeking out the opportunities, that they are looking for Chinese men, that they are happily dedicating their lives to Chinese families, and that they will be good wives. And some of the images you can see here. The value of Chinese, and that's one of these important things for this series of talks, is the value. So value, quantitative and qualitative. The value of white woman for Chinese man. I would bring up a quote from my research, is that it's like a precious stone for Chinese man. To have her is beautiful and prestigious. You'll definitely have beautiful, clever children. The topic of children constantly comes up. To have a foreign wife is solid foundation for a Chinese face. To link it with academic research on female Buddhism, Chinese national imagination, I will link it with works by Susan Greenlaw and Louisa Shine, who in the early 90s were writing about this topic, and they were talking about how white female Buddhists have been represented in Chinese media, and they were presented as objects of admiration, desire, longing, and qualities which China lacked at the time. So they were the kind of quiet quality people which China wasn't at the time. And this representations of Russian women or Ukrainian women that fulfills at least two closely related national goals / fantasies. It's a rectification of the skewed sex ratio, which is largely myth, because there are but no way 30 million women who would be willing to marry Chinese man, so it's simply unrealistic. But there is other more important goal, its national desire to become a powerful, respected world power through conquering white female voice. And Jeremy Barmey, Susan Cronla, and Bill Calhoun all been writing about these topics. I have 10 minutes, so I will probably have to speed up. I wanted to allude to is, although in the media, in Chinese media, the idea of agency is being increasingly emphasized. So we need to create, set up more agencies or help people to meet. In fact, what I've been finding in my research that the majority of people didn't meet through agencies. People meet by chance. And the main routes for this encounters, cross-border encounters, being created in the post-Soviet period through closer links between the two countries. It's the mobility of Chinese men to Russia and to post-Soviet countries, and its proliferation of language exchanges, more opportunities for young people from those countries to go to China, to study, to work, to on very short trip exchanges. And most women who met there, Chinese husband never planned to look for a Chinese boyfriend. It happened by chance. The decisions to marry into China were prompted by periods, short or long, but periods of romantic relationship, and sometimes visa issues. If they wanted to stay in China, and then they thought it would be easier to stay in China if they marry, and sometimes pregnancy. But what was also interesting that no matter how women ended up in China, many talk about a particular aspect of kind of marriage as an institute in China. They felt that through marrying and then living in China, they felt objectified in many different ways. It's this custom in China, for example, of bride's price, which many women didn't know about and then found out in the process. It's it's the big weddings, which parents insist on organizing, and so forth. So although marriage has been free choice and voluntary, it was very common for women to talk about the sense of insecurity and objectification which their marriage and their married life in China led to. Few slides about kind of crossing borders for married life and experiences of women, so what women talk about. And that's where you really know, well, I really noticed the disjunction between the representations in the media and the cultural sphere in China and official discourses and the experiences. Social welfare and insecurity. Many women talk about the fact that medical care is very expensive and most of them don't have insurance. So this respondent was talking about her recent medical condition, that she's 42 years old, she's ill, she needs medical care, but she needs to pay 100% for her care in hospital. She doesn't have insurance, I don't have medical book here, I don't have any rights here at all. How to let the government know that if they let marriages with foreigners, then they should give those foreigners some rights so that we don't find ourselves in the position of a slave. Wash dishes, cook dinner, look after children, take the children to school, pick them up from school, do homework with them. I'm IE. I'm no more than IE is a domestic worker in China. IE has more rights than I do because at least she has an insurance and I don't have anything here at all. Many women talk about their emotional struggles, kind of adaptation to very different cultural kind of framework kind of, and the mindset. and talking about themselves as kind of losing themselves in the transition. I lost myself, to go, give you another quote somewhere, because in any case it's a different culture, language, cuisine, your opportunities to realize yourself here are very limited. I had psychological meltdowns from time to time. There are moments when I feel like packing up and going home. The husband provides for a woman completely. She becomes a slave. Even if he is a kind and caring man, not a tyrant, she depends on him. And most of these issues come up because of the restrictions in the current legislation in China. Immigration law is very new, 2013, and one section of the law deals specifically with marriage migration. So there is a new visa category Q, which grants the status of foreign spouses in China, and with visa Q, the main restriction that you are not allowed to work. You're not allowed to work until you've got a long-term residency, 10-year residency, after 5 years of being married. However, to get this residency is very difficult because it's costly. You need to reserve a large amount of money. In Beijing, it's 200,000 yuan for at least a year. And there are a number of other restrictions, such as living in China for at least 9 months a year, which for some women is unacceptable, they like going home, and so forth. So, renewal of this family visa depends on the willingness of the husband, in this case, to sponsor, to become a sponsor every 1 to 2 years. But also, what's even more significant, that even though you have a right to become a permanent resident, there is no route to full citizenship in China for foreigners, including those who are spouses, legal spouses of Chinese citizens. So you can be a long-term family visitor and resident, but never a full national in China. And it brings up tensions and thorny issues, in particular in relation to the status of children. So although foreign spouses can become full citizens, it doesn't apply to their children. Because children who are born to such marriages, they automatically become Chinese citizens, according to 1981 nationality law. And here where I draw on the work of Sarah Smith, who talks about the birth of a child as a territorial project. Because although they are immediately absorbed into the kind of national sphere, national project of China, it doesn't apply to the spouses. And where that's where the external and internal boundaries of Chinese citizenship are significant. Those who work on citizenship, like Biao and Mika, know that in China it's, there are two kind of dimensions of Chinese citizenship. One external, it has to do with nationality, body, and another one is internal, hukou system, the household registration, which gives full range of citizenship rights to Chinese nationals, but at the same time divides them into rural and urban populations. But if you're not written into hukou, then you are restricted from access to those rights. So it has implications to these children, because for and causes a lot of tension in discussion between foreign spouses and their national Chinese citizen families and husbands. Because for me, women, if they give full citizenship to their Chinese children, it means that they will have different status in China from their children, and they feel that it jeopardizes their parental rights. So in the event of divorce, what happens? I go home, nothing keeps me in China, but what happens to my child if he's a full Chinese citizen? And from a kind of experiences and observations, women arrive to conclusion that it's better to have the same citizenship with their children in China, which at the same time restricts the rights of those children to education, to medical care, and so forth. So that's a very kind of an area of passion and internal conflicts in the families of these wives. Another important dimension, which is related again, that's important to see how these legal dimensions bleed into the cultural differences. And women talk about different attitudes to children. For example, that's an Orthodox icon of a holy family. And pay attention to who holds the baby. It's a nuclear family, so it's mother, father, and the baby. Maybe Jesus by Mary. So, and that's the ideal representation of the Chinese family, Confucian family, four generations of family living together under one roof. And it symbolizes the ideas of harmony, happiness, longevity, and a large thriving family, the more the better. And here, who holds the children? It's the grandmother, it's the mother of father. And so these different conceptions of what constitutes a happy family, how family roles are distributed, and who the baby belongs to are sources of many kind of tensions in these families. Women talk about not feeling that the baby is theirs. For example, to give you a flavor of responses I was getting from women. It's normal in case of divorce for a Chinese woman to leave her child with the husband's family and continue her sense of happiness. But we don't leave our children behind. We have a very different mentality. My ex-husband was even offering me money so that I leave our son with him. I told him that my son is part of me, my heart and soul, but it's pointless to talk about him about it. Where I come from, Ukraine, the newborn baby is her mother's child, while in China the child belongs to the society. So the women really feel that if they don't have the same citizenship with the child, then if something happens, the Chinese family will keep the baby and it stays in China. And that causes a lot of kind of anxiety and insecurity for many of those women. So I'm coming, I think I'll wrap up. We can talk about adaptations, strategy adaptations in the Q&A, but I'll try to stick to 1 hour. So, concluding thoughts. I hope I convinced you that intimate geopolitics is a useful heuristic, analytical lens to think about marriage migration and use it for analysis, to tease out some of these co-constitutive elements and relations happening across several spheres. I was talking about Chinese national anxiety over the loss and lack of women and how it's been gendered, racialized, part of national security, and how women, these post-Soviet women, fit into these discourses. And there is an apparent growing role of party states, market, and individuals in China promoting marriages with women from post-Soviet countries, seen as a way out of the demographic situation problem in China. And what I've been finding that the emotional, cultural, legal border crossing experiences of these women are very different from how they are represented in China. And in particular, the a lot of tensions and conflicts in these families emerge from how the status of women is contrasted to the status of children, who embody the sides of citizenship claims and intercultural negotiations. And I'll stop here. Thank you very much.